So turn with me to John chapter 21. And this is what a lot of people title the epilogue of John. You know, it's kind of the story's kind of climax and it's over, but there's still some issues to resolve. You guys are familiar with this concept, I'm sure. It's kind of like Lord of the Rings, right? They defeat Sauron, but then all of a sudden there's some stuff at the Shire that has to be tidied up. So, same concept. But in verse 1, after these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and in this way he showed himself. So it says after these things, and it's speaking about, you know, the disciples were in Jerusalem. They went through, you know, the Passover, and then there's the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's that week-long event afterwards. You know, after the crucifixion, the resurrection, their time in Jerusalem, Jesus appearing to his disciples there. You know, after those things. So they've left Jerusalem, and we're finally back to Galilee. Aren't you guys excited? I mean, we spent so much time in Galilee earlier on in the semester, and now we're back there. It's like a familiar place. Because the Sea of Tiberias is actually, you remember what else it's called? The Sea of Galilee, yeah. So same place, it's just that big sea that's in the north where most of the disciples are from originally. But what's interesting about this is it says, in this way, he showed himself. Now, you can translate that showed or manifested, right? In this way, he manifested himself to his disciples. It's not just that, you know, he was visible to their eyes. That's not what it is being kind of expressed here in this section. But it's more Jesus is revealing his character and his nature to his disciples here in the Galilee. Right? He's going to meet with them, and they're not just going to see him, but they're going to experience him. Right? They're going to have fellowship with him. You know, he's going to continue to prove that he came bodily, right? That his resurrection was a real resurrection that happened bodily. That he continues to exist in this resurrected body, and that he exists in power, in love, and in sympathy of the human condition, though, right? That just because he's resurrected doesn't mean he doesn't care about us. You know, it's like you see, okay, Jesus really identifies with humanity because he took on humanity. And it might be easy to say, okay, well, now that he's resurrected, you know, it's like one of those friends who's gone on to other things and they kind of forget about you. Well, that's not Jesus, right? He's not a forgetful friend. He's not somebody who's gone on to better things. What he came to accomplish was his work on the cross, and he accomplished that for us, right? For his children, for his disciples. So it's not as if Jesus has moved on. It's like, well, that was that chapter in his life, and now that's over. He's doing other things. He still cares. He still cares for humanity, and he continues to prove that in his post-resurrection appearances here. But in verse 2, it says, Simon Peter and Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing. And they said to him, we are going with you also. They went out and immediately got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. So we see a few different individuals here. There's like seven disciples that are in Galilee that we know that are listed here. There might have been more that are around, but we know there's Simon Peter. We know him. There's Thomas called the twin or Dudamus. Nathanael of Cana. We read about him all the way back in chapter 2. And there's the sons of Zebedee. You guys remember who the sons of Zebedee are? We kind of touched on this. James and John, right? The brothers. And then there's two other anonymous disciples. Like, how would you feel if you were reading John's account and, like, you're like, oh, yeah, like, that's me. I'm one of these other guys who doesn't get a name. You actually probably wouldn't be reading it because at this point you'd probably be dead because most of them were martyred at this point. But that's besides the fact. It's, you know, it doesn't really matter who they are. They're just some disciples who are there with them. But this section reminds us of when Jesus commissioned his disciples. When he first calls Peter to the ministry, he tells them, you can read about it in Mark chapter 1, verse 17. It says, then Jesus said to them, follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men. Because what was their occupation? You know, a lot of them were fishers or fishermen. That's what they would do to survive. They seemed to have like a fishing business. Now, you know, they left it to become disciples of Jesus. Jesus promised them, I'm going to make you fishers of men. He's basically, you know, changing their occupation. He's saying, you're going to go after a catch, but your catch will now be men for his purposes, right? And now after the resurrection, they're up in Galilee, and what are they doing again? They're going back to their old profession, their old occupation, fishing. And I think it, you can't help but, you know, see the connection between who they used to be before Jesus met them and what they're doing right now. You know, and this is how Jesus first called Peter, was while he was fishing, and called him away from his nets, away from his boat. And Peter is the one that we see in verse 3. It says, Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing. So Peter seems to lead this group of seven disciples into their old profession. And Peter really is this man of action, right? We see throughout the Gospels, it's like, what do you know about Peter? Is he does stuff, right? He acts, he responds. It's like something's happening, and Peter's like, okay, let's go. Let's do something, or let's respond to this in some way. And sometimes it's really awesome. Like Peter makes these professions of faith, you know, where the rest of the disciples are just kind of sitting there. You know, who do people say that I am? And Peter's like, you're the Christ, you know, it's cool. And sometimes it's not so awesome, right? He's like, let's build a tabernacle to you, Jesus, and we'll build one for Moses, and we'll build one for Elijah. And then God rebukes him. It's like, whoops, you know, maybe that wasn't the right thing to say. When God rebukes you audibly, you know you're like making a mistake, right? For sure. Like, that's one of the for sure ones. But we see that they're out fishing. And it says at the end of verse 3 that they went out and immediately got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. So it seems like they're fishing all night long. And that was a common practice, is that if you're a fisherman, you'd go out all night and fish, and then in the morning you bring your catch in so you could sell it at market, right? So it's not like this is something strange. It's like, okay, this is what you would normally do while you're fishing. They're just kind of doing the normal fishing thing right now. But when we look at Peter in like acting, responding, he kind of takes this leadership role. You know, compare him to John, though, throughout the gospel. And John is like that gospel. John is that like contemplative. He likes to see what's going on. He thinks about it. You know, when they're at the tomb, what do we see? That John's there first, right? But he doesn't go in. Peter, when he finally gets there, he goes in and he sees like what's going on. And it's like he's looking around. But what happens when John sees, it says he believes, right? John is more of like the contemplative type, the thinker. It's like he meditates on this. Okay, what does this mean? And he comes to conclusions. Peter is like action man, right? He's like, we're going to go do this. Let's I'm going fishing. And everybody's like, yeah, okay, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do that. So Peter seems to act before he thinks, and John seems to understand before Peter, under normal circumstances. And I think for us, right, when we're looking at this, it's good to learn from his mistakes and his example in terms of Peter, right? Because with Peter, there are times where he probably shouldn't have made those rash decisions that he made, right? If he would have been patient, if he would have thought it through, he probably wouldn't have done some of the things that he did. But on the other hand, you know, Peter seems to take a prominent role in the early church. Why? Because he has faith and he acts upon his faith, right? I don't want to just come and like paint this like one-sided picture of Peter. You know, it's like, oh, Peter, the most horrible apostle that was ever existed, right? He's so stupid and does everything wrong. Well, that's not true about Peter. Like, there are times in your life where you're going to have to act based on faith. You're going to step out not knowing how it's going to, you know, work out. And God's calling us to that radical faith. You know, it seems like Peter has that faith. There are going to be times where God's going to call you, much like the Apostle John, to sit and meditate and just be still before him and not jump out, right? Not go out and do something ahead of God, not say, okay, like, this is what God's doing and I'm going to go make it happen, though. We need to be dependent upon God and his resources. I think we can learn from both sides and both characters here. You know, know, both of these apostles have something for us to learn. And I think also what we see is that God uses different types of people to accomplish his work. You know, you don't have to be a Peter. You don't have to be a John, right? You have to be who God called you to be, though. You don't look at this other person and say, oh, I'm going to be that person. You know, I just want to be like them because they're an awesome Christian. It's like, well, no, you need to listen to the Lord and respond to him how God is calling you. That's what's going to make you an effective minister of the gospel. It's not copying someone else and saying, okay, like this is how they do it and I'm going to do it. But being who the Lord made you to be and responding when he calls you to something. And we see with Peter, you know, he takes this role of leadership, and maybe he wasn't asking for a role of leadership, right? He's not saying, everybody, like, we're going to go fishing, come with me, this is what we need to do. He just says, I'm going fishing, and other people say, oh, you know what, I'm going to go with you. But leadership comes with responsibility. Yeah, Ty. Yeah, and that's possible. There's actually a few different ideas of what's happening here among, like, good Bible scholars, right? So these are people who are all equally qualified to come to conclusions. And just like you guys, I mean, you can come to conclusions, too. Sometimes we disagree about stuff. And so we're going to look at that. We'll get back to that idea, though, about, like, what's going on here. You know, is Peter, like, is he really resisting God? Or is he, you know, just doing something that's okay? Are you allowed to fish as a Christian, right? Don't tell Daniel Lomeli, but the Bible says that you shouldn't fish if you're a Christian. No, I don't think it says that. But, you know, but with our leadership, right, even if you're not in a willful position of leadership, right, oh, I'm going to lead these people, people often follow our example and our lead when we step out. You know, that comes with that comes responsibility. If you lead out, people follow. That happens. And sometimes we think that leadership is always about going out and doing something, right? It's like, well, you got to make a decision to do something new. Well, that's not true. Sometimes in leadership, leaders choose to not change things. And that's still a choice. That's a choice to make the status quo, like that the status quo, how things are right now, is correct, right? So anytime you're in leadership, you're always making decisions. If you're not changing anything, you're making a decision to not change anything. If you are changing things, you're making a decision to change things. So whatever you're doing, right, you can't just cop out and say, well, I didn't change anything, so I'm not responsible. You need to be before the Lord and saying, okay, God, what's the best thing to do right here? Is it to do what we've been doing, or is it to do something different? What are you calling me to? And once again, you know, you really need to be dependent upon the Lord. You can't just, like, go out and try to do things in your own strength or not change anything. It's like, okay, well, this is okay because I'm not changing anything, so I'm not responsible. We need to be dependent upon God for all of our actions, whether it's saying, I approve of what's going on and we need to continue doing this, or whether it's, you know what, we need to change what we're doing and do something different. It really takes dependence upon God. So, the question is, though, and I think it's Ty kind of brought it up, it's a good question, was Peter forsaking the ministry here? Because what do we know about what's just happened? We know that Jesus died. We know that he rose again. We know that he appeared to his disciples, so they know that he's walking around, right, and alive. So what's Peter doing, right? Why is he going and fishing in Galilee? Is he forsaking, the ministry of the gospel? Is he saying, I'm not going to be a fisher of men, I'm going to be a fisher of fish, that's all that I'm good for? We know that he denied the Lord three times before witnesses, right? Before he went to the cross. After declaring he would die for him, right? That he'd never forsake him. That's got to be a pretty tough thing to go through. Within Scripture, this is the only section that talks about, their time up in the Galilee here, John 21. It doesn't make an indication about like whether this was good or bad, what's happening here, right? There's no indication in Scripture of what Peter's state of mind. We don't know what his motives are behind it. It might just be, oh, like, you know, we're up here and we got to do something, so let's fish. Or it might be, oh, like, I'm, like, so bummed out and I just can't minister for the Lord. I'm going back to what I know how to do. There are commentators who fall on both sides of it. And since people are just saying, this is what I think and this is what I think, I'm going to tell you what I think. And then you guys can agree or disagree with me, too. My personal belief is that they're in Galilee because they're following after Jesus. This is actually a really good example of having the context of all the Gospels helps you understand a story. Because if you guys look at Matthew chapter 28, verses 9 through 10, in that Jesus tells some of his disciples who are women to go tell his 12 disciples to meet him in Galilee. Right? He tells them, give them this message that they ought to meet me in Galilee. So Jesus tells these women to tell his disciples to meet in the Galilee. It's only in Matthew's gospel. But when you connect that with them being in the Galilee, in John's gospel, it makes a lot more sense. It's like, oh, well, yeah, of course they're in Galilee. It's not that they're running away. It's that Jesus said, I'm going to meet you guys there. You need to go to Galilee. So that's consistent with them following after Jesus. And, like, Jesus isn't there, so what else are they going to do? They're by the lake. They got all the gear. Let's go fishing. That's what we know how to do. But, you know, maybe not. Maybe it was that they kind of despaired. I don't know. It seems difficult to believe that in light of Jesus resurrecting and appearing to them. I just find that hard to believe. It's like you saw someone you know was crucified, alive and walking around, tells you, meet me in Galilee. We've got something to do. He says, receive my spirit, right? It's like, I don't think that they'd be walking away from the ministry. Yeah, Tyler.
They haven't been fishing for 3 years.
Yeah, man, they haven't been. Yeah, good point. Yeah, Logan. It's Matthew chapter 28, verses 9 through 10, is where Jesus tells the women to go tell the disciples. So that's something that we don't get in John's gospel. I mean, he talks to Mary Magdalene, but it seems like he appears to another group of women. One of the 12 post-resurrection appearances of Jesus. So what we learn, though, is that they caught nothing. You know, they went fishing at the appropriate hour. They were fishing early through the night. They were experienced fishers, and they put in this effort, and they don't get anything. Yeah, Kira. Well, because they were following Jesus. I mean, it's possible they would have been fishing in that time, but Jesus had an itinerant ministry where he's traveling around. If they're in Jerusalem, which it seems like they're spending a lot of time in Jerusalem, they're not fishing there. They don't have their fishing boats, and they forsake, like, their jobs, essentially, in the Galilee to follow after and become Jesus' disciples. And so that seems like a normal thing would have been for them to go with him and travel with him everywhere that he went and not be fishers. And Jesus had a 3-year ministry, so depending on who you ask. I mean, it could have been 2 years or 3.5, but that's not super important. So it says in verse 4, but when morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Then Jesus said to them, children, have you any food? And they answered him, no. Why didn't they recognize him? I'm not sure, right? Same thing with Mary Magdalene in the garden. Why didn't she recognize Jesus? Was it something that God was doing? Did it have to do with the early hour? You know, is it like some sort of supernatural barrier? I'm not sure. I just know that they don't recognize him, and then they do recognize him. So that's what's going on here. Same kind of concept, whatever the reason is. Verse 6, and he said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. So they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. And so it's so funny, right? Jesus the carpenter comes in and tells the fishermen, hey, let me tell you how to fish. And what you see in the Gospels is you never see the disciples catching fish, right? What do we know about them? Like, a lot of them are fishermen. You never see them in the Gospels catching fish without Jesus' help. I mean, I think that's kind of funny on one end. It's like, oh, like, you know, there's another time previous where Jesus tells them to, like, cast in again. They're like, oh, but we've been fishing. And then they do it, and they catch, you know, so many fish that it, like, pretty much breaks their net. And then there's that time where Jesus tells Peter, it's like he's supposed to pay the temple tax, and he tells him, well, why don't you go to the lake, get a fish, and it has the money to pay the temple tax in there. So it's like that's the only times we see the apostles catching fish is when Jesus Christ is helping them out. And I think for us, that really represents, you know, that he is the provider for all of our needs. Their profession, right, their occupation, the thing that they would fall back on in hard times to survive, they can only accomplish with Jesus Christ. You know, and I think that really reminds me that he is our provider in every area. You know, no matter what you're doing, say you're an electrician, right? You don't know more about being an electrician than Jesus does. I guarantee you that if you rely upon Jesus Christ as an electrician, you're going to be a better electrician. It's so practical, right? If you are, like, on your M199, like, say you're a librarian, right? And you're like, oh, man, like, I'm so good at librarianing. I promise you that Jesus Christ can help you be a better librarian, right? You might think, oh, what does Jesus care about me being a librarian, right? What does he care about me being an electrician? What does he care about me being a fisherman, right? He's the provider for all of your needs. Don't separate parts of your life. Don't say, like, this is secular and this is sacred, and that, you know, these are the parts that I really have control of my life and I can do and I'm qualified and able to do it, and these are the parts that I'll let Jesus have control of. We don't see that in the Gospels, right? We don't see, like, areas of the apostles' life where they're sufficient. What we see is that Jesus Christ makes people sufficient for his ministry, whether it's in what we would call a secular realm or if we, you know, you might call it, like, a sacred realm. It doesn't matter. So the disciples catch fish. Why? Because Jesus is around and helping them out. And therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it, and plunged into the sea. So once again, John understands first, right? He recognizes, like, that's the Lord. I know it is. And then who acts first, though? Peter, right? What does Peter do? He, like, grabs onto his clothes and they jump in. I mean, this is maybe a little weird. You're like, what? He's not wearing clothes. And it's like the Greek text, it could mean naked, but that kind of has, like, a broader, like, semantic range. It could just mean that they were, you know, like, not wearing all of their outer garments. And I think it's kind of like, you know, workers today. Like, if you go to a construction site where they're not real strict, you're going to see guys without their shirts on, right? Because guys just like working in as little clothes as possible. I think that's always been the case. But he probably grabbed his outer garment and put it on, and he just jumps into the sea and swims out, right? He plunged into the sea. And, you know, I see that God gifts people in different ways. We see that John, he's that man of vision, right? He sees the Lord, and he's like, he recognizes it. That's the Lord. Peter is that man of action. He sees the Lord. He responds to it. He jumps into the water, whatever obstacle is there. He doesn't care about, like, looking cool or something. It's just like, there he is. I'm going to go to the Lord. Yeah, Brian.
So why would he put on his outer garment?
So he could have it with him probably when he gets to shore, I'm assuming.
So.
Yeah. Good point. I mean, the other option is he'd be naked, right? So, wet and clothed, or dry and naked, or almost naked. So we see them responding in other ways. In verse 8, but the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 200 cubits, dragging the net with fish. Then, as soon as they had come to land, they saw a fire of coals there and fish laid on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish which you have just caught. And so 200 cubits is about 300 feet. cubit is about 18 inches. So, you know, Peter jumps in, he swims ashore, the rest of them are struggling with this net that's full of fish, and they're dragging it behind them. And when they get there, they see Jesus is there, and he already has, like, a fire laid out, he already has fish on it, you know, so it's like he's still providing for them. And everybody gets there at the same time, not at the same time, but everybody gets there, right? Like, Peter's there first because he just, like, books it. The other disciples kind of finish up. They're probably much more practical. It's like somebody's got to drag these fish in, right? And I don't know. When you look at that situation, like, Peter probably had the much more gratifying way of getting to the Lord, though. I mean, there's something to be spoken about his devotion, that he is fully devoted to the Lord. I mean, you look at him, how he was, and, like, he denied the Lord before other people. And it's like, yeah, he's not a perfect man, right? He's hasn't been a perfect minister, yet you can see his devotion to the Lord, that he casts off any sort of, like, you know, social expectations, or, you know, what he dropped anything that he was doing because he sees the Lord, because he's devoted to him. And, you know, I bet, like, when he got there, there's just, like, that just sense of joy that he had because he's willing to give up, you know, anything. I think the same is true for us. You know, people are devoted to the Lord in different ways. But when you can really cast off everything else and say, nothing else matters to me except for my relationship with Jesus Christ, it's going to affect your life. Like, it really will affect you. And we're going to see that with Peter. You know, his devotion to the Lord is what's going to make him qualified for ministry. Right? It's not his past. It's not his accomplishments. It's not his qualifications. But it's his relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's where the commission is going to be sourced out of him. We'll cover that in this chapter. But we see his devotion. And, you know, he's not just, like, totally a flake, though. You know, like, some people, they're so spiritual that they don't ever help you with anything practical. You're just like, thanks. Oh, no, I'm just going to, like, pray and fast. It's like, well, yeah, but we got to clean our dorm. It's like, yeah, but I've got to pray, you know. It's like, I'm just going to be doing it. And you're like, okay, well, thank you. Simon Peter wasn't just, like, you know, totally ignoring what was going on there. It says in verse 11, Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not broken. So this was a lot of fish, right? 153. Who fishes in here? Have you guys ever gone net fishing? Yeah, like, not in a tanker, right? Like, how many fish have you caught? Two, okay, two fish. Kaylin? In a day, even.
A day?
Yeah. 20, okay, yeah. Like, that's a lot of fish, right? They're just fishermen. That's like one net full of 153 fish. And, like, some people have made a pretty big deal about this number, 153, right? In fact, who was it? It was Jerome. He's like an early church father. He said that there were 153 types of fish in the Sea of Galilee. And so what Jesus did was that they had one of each of those fish in their nets. Now, that's not verifiable by either the Bible or any external resources, so I wouldn't take that, but it's kind of a cool story, right? What's really going on here is, just like in real life, if you were to catch, like, a ton of fish, you would be like, man, we caught a ton of fish. How many was it? And you'd count them. Right? Because it's like, I don't know, let's find out. I think they just caught so many fish, like, we got to see how many this is. They counted them, since it's a real story, right? It's a real event that happened in history, and John was there, and he remembers, dude, we caught 153 fish that day. It was incredible. It was like provision from Jesus of all these fish. I know the exact number. That's what I think is more likely, right? There's not, like, necessarily a mystical or spiritual significance to it, but they caught a bunch of fish, they counted it because they were curious, how many did we get? But we see that Jesus providing for them, right? He provided more fish than they could possibly eat. And that is Jesus as our provider. He provides more than we need, right? He provides more than we could possibly use. He has resources beyond what we need, and he's able to provide them. Yeah, did you have a question or a comment? That's right. So he had fish that were not from their catch. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know how he got them. Maybe he did the whole, like, walk up to the thing and, like, fish would jump out. And maybe they had gold coins or drachmas in there, too. I don't know. Right? It just, he had fish. Maybe he bought them. It doesn't say, you know. That's. But what we see is that he's providing for them, right? And he continues to provide. Not only does he provide the fish in their nets, but he also provides fish to join in the meal. And what Jesus is doing is he really is playing the role of a host here, right? That the host would provide the meal, you know, the head of the household would usually pass out the food to the people that were eating them. And we're seeing he's taking that position in the disciples' life as, you know, the head, the leader, the host, the one that cares for them, provides for them, is making sure things are in order for them. You know, even though they had fish to offer, Jesus brought his own fish. And he was cooking it for them and had it prepared. And Jesus said to them in verse 12, "Come and eat breakfast." Yet none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus then came and took bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. This is now the third time Jesus showed himself to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. So, and that's in John's gospel, right? We see there's three times that he appears to his disciples. Once is the first time without Thomas there. Then the second time is when everybody's there, including Thomas, and Thomas professes him as his Lord and his God, worships him. And then this is the third time while they're together here in Galilee. So it's the third time Jesus showed himself to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. And they now know the risen Lord, right? They recognize him. They know who he is. And when we look at Jesus' interaction with his disciples in this section, we really see that Jesus is the provider for his disciples, right? He provides the fish. He not just provides them fish through their catch, but he's cooking them a meal. He says, "Come eat breakfast with me." He's the provider. We also see that he's a sustainer for those who are serving him. They caught so many fish that they would have expected the net to break, right? Why would you mention the net didn't break? Do you normally say, "Yeah, I was in my car today and my car didn't even break"? Unless you're expecting that your car would break. Some of us have those vehicles. You're like so surprised. It made it like to Winco and back and it didn't break down once. This is incredible. But right, you don't mention that unless there's an expectation of it breaking. The same thing with the net. There were 153 fish, but the net didn't even break. He's a sustainer for those who are serving him. And finally, we see that he has fellowship with those that are serving him. That he invited his disciples to come and eat with him. You know, it's just like an intimate thing. And in their culture, you know, eating together with someone there was a lot more social commitment involved in that than when we go out to eat with someone, right? You're saying that, hey, we are working together. You are welcome at my house. You're essentially like my family. You know, we're in agreement. And when he invites them to have breakfast with him, you know, he's extending that fellowship to his disciples. You know, he's telling them, come, eat with me. You know, spend time, interact with me. And Jesus is doing the same thing today with his disciples. Now, there's obviously not like a morning, like physical breakfast that Jesus provides for you guys, right? You can't like go out to the lake there and there's a fire of coals and be like, yeah, Jesus totally laid out this fish boat, like, you know, banquet for us this morning. This is great. But in terms of spiritual, there's a spiritual banquet available every day for us. Christ, that we can meet with him. We can meet with him first thing, right? We don't have to do anything else. We can meet with Christ. And we can have a spiritual banquet where he will provide for us. I promise you that Jesus is providing for you on a daily basis. That if you feel that you lack something spiritually, how many of you guys sometimes in here feel that you lack? I mean, I feel that way. That it's like, man, Lord, I am missing something. Jesus has a spiritual banquet available for you. He wants to have fellowship with you. The option is there for you each day to partake with. Now, what if when Jesus invited his disciples, come have breakfast. What if they're like, you know what? I'm busy. You know, I got some other things to do. Like, maybe I'll catch you tomorrow, Jesus. Like, when we're reading that story, we'd be like, are you crazy? Like, what, are you, you're kidding me. Like, listen, Judas. Like, come on, get back in the camp. Go have breakfast with Jesus. Right? That's insane. The same thing's true for us today, right? So often we neglect banquets with Jesus. We're saying, no, like, I'll get to it another time. I'll do it tomorrow, right? It's like, man, if Jesus was offering fish on the lake right now, I guarantee you guys that I would, like, be out of this class in, like, 2 seconds flat. I'd be like, class is canceled. You guys, Jesus is cooking fish on the lake. I don't even really care for fish, but I would be there, right? And I would eat it. I'd be like, this is great. Thank you, Jesus. Why? Because you get to spend time with Christ. And that concept, like, makes sense to me physically, right? It's like, if Jesus is physically there, if he's serving up, like, physical fish, it's real. I understand it. It's like, that makes sense to me. Then why doesn't it make sense to me when Jesus is offering a spiritual banquet for me every morning, that I can get up and I can spend time with Christ? The best thing about the spiritual feast that Christ has for you is that it never runs out, right? There's never a time where you can't feast upon that banquet. There's never a time when you can't have fellowship or with communion with Christ, because he went and ascended to the Father, because he sent his Spirit. What the disciples are experiencing here, which we think, oh, that's so cool, it would have been so sweet to have, like, fish with Jesus, we get to experience that in a deeper way than they're experiencing here with Jesus. That we have fellowship with Christ, of which they don't know until they receive the Holy Spirit. That's the benefit that we have today as disciples of Christ, is that we have fellowship that goes beyond what the people who were living with Christ in his day had. It's such a blessing. It's such a, you know, just a, it's such a gift to us as believers, and we can take advantage of it as often as we like. So if you were one of those people that said sometimes, like, I just feel like I lack spiritually, I want to encourage you, when you feel spiritual lack, go to the source, right? If you told me, oh man, I just feel so hungry right now and I just don't know what to do, I would tell you, go eat something, right? Like, what? Don't be stupid. You're hungry, eat. That's the way that you solve hunger. How do you solve spiritual famine? Is you spend time investing in spiritual things. Don't be stupid. Don't be blinded by the world and material things. Don't be convinced that this world is all that there is. Satan wants to deceive you and trick you, even as a Christian, right? He wants to make you think, oh, what's happening, what's real is this world. And it's like, yeah, I kind of believe in spiritual things. Those things need to be just as real to you as the physical objects, right? As the physical food that you eat. That there ought to be times where you neglect physical food because you know that you need that time for spiritual nourishment. Why? Because it's just as important, maybe more important. Yeah, you need to eat to live. You should survive, right? It's not spiritual to stop eating and die because of it. But do you see the spiritual realm as one that's real? Do you lack in the spiritual things? Then feast upon the spiritual things. Have communion with the Lord. Have fellowship with him. Seek him. You know, are you hungry spiritually? Then feast. And so we see that in verse 15 it says, so when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? Okay, so in this section coming up here, it's super famous, right? If you know about the Bible, like, I don't know, are scriptures famous? This one's famous. Like, this is a famous section. It's where Jesus is, like, asking Peter, do you love me? And he says, you know that I love you. And he keeps asking him. And we're going to see that there's parallels between this interaction with Christ and the interaction of Peter when he's denying Christ. And so, I mean, these are linked, not just in terms of, like, okay, well, you know, he denied him. They're linked with structure. They're linked with the actual, like, the setting. They're linked with language, too. Like, there's similar language used involving Peter's denial of Christ and Christ's commissioning of Peter here for the work of the gospel. So when we read through this section, keep in mind, you know, Peter's denial of Christ, and then when we're done with that, we'll go ahead and compare them. But also, when he commissions Peter, he's commissioning him to watch over the flock. And he's going to use terms that are indicative of a shepherd with his sheep, you know, with his livestock. And remember that in the Old Testament, right, God saw his people as his sheep. So the chosen people of God are his sheep. In the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, and the New Covenant too, you know, that picture carries over. And the faithful rulers are seen as shepherds. In Jeremiah 3, verse 15, he says, "And I will give you shepherds according to my heart, who will feed you with knowledge and understanding." That's the promise of God to his people in Jeremiah 3:15. And we looked at the Jews throughout John's gospel, right? And as a nation, the Jews have rejected Christ. And kind of in John's gospel, the figurehead of that rejection is the leadership of the Jews seen through the Pharisees, right? Throughout John's gospel, you see the Pharisees coming. Every time Jesus is doing a miracle, who's opposing it? Well, it's the Jewish people as a whole, but it's the Pharisees specifically too, right? They're the ones who are plotting and planning against Jesus to arrest him and kill him. And so we see that the Pharisees are considered unfaithful shepherds of God's people. And so Christ here is now looking for faithful shepherds of this new community, right? It's the community of faith. It's not based on who your father was. It's not based on, like, oh, like we are children of Abraham, and so we're automatically in the community. We're automatically in God's chosen people. Now, God's chosen people are the people of faith. And Jesus is setting up shepherds for his people, right? Because he wants them to grow. He wants them to thrive. He wants them to mature in him. And in order to do that, he's going to set out his own faithful shepherds to replace these wicked and unfaithful shepherds that the Pharisees were found to be. And so, in verse 15, "So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter," and so he singles him out, right, among the group, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?" And so this question is an interesting question. It could refer to three different things. It's, do you love me more than these? As in, compared to the other disciples, who loves me more, you, Peter, or these disciples? The other way, another way it could be taken is the question that Jesus is asking him, do you love me, Peter, more than you love the disciples, or you care about their opinion, or you care about how you're seen before them, right? So that's more of a, do you love me more than you love the opinion of these men who are with you, or that you care for them? The third is, Peter, do you love me more than these referring to the fish, right? And not just like, do you love these fish so much, but like, are you going back to fishing, right? Because that's one option that people see, is that like, oh, Peter is forsaking his ministry and going back to fishing. And so when he encounters Jesus, the question is, do you love me more? Do you want to be a fisher of men or a man fishing, right? So those are the three options. I think it makes sense if you look at Matthew 26:33, in terms of comparison to the other disciples, Peter has said this. Matthew 26:33, "Peter answered and said to him, 'Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble.'" Right? And then Jesus tells him, "I promise you that you're going to deny me three times before the day's out," pretty much. "Before tomorrow comes, you're going to deny me." Even though he said, "Even if everybody rejects you, I won't." And so that question makes sense to me, Because, you know, before he was boasting, before the other disciples, it's like, I love you so much, Christ. I love you more than anyone, right? If everyone else rejects you, well, you know what? I'm not going to. And so Jesus asks him this question. Peter, do you love me more than these others do? Right? In light of the rejection of Christ, you know, that must have been a very cutting question for him. You know, it must have been hard for him to deal with something like that. Because, you know, when you've done something wrong and you know about it, the other person knows about it, but nobody's saying anything, right? And there's just like kind of this elephant in the room. You're just like, okay, like, is he thinking about it right now? Like, everything that's said, you interpret it in light of, oh, man, I totally messed up. And here Jesus asks the question, right? He mentions the elephant in the room. He's like, do you love me more than these two? And that must have just, you know, brought back the whole circumstance of him denying Christ, him promising to follow him, promising to stick with him, even though everybody else rejected him. And then he denied him three times before people. You know, and the last time he boasted that though everyone else would stumble, he would not. He put himself above the others, right? He set himself in a position. He said, I, Peter, am in a position that's greater than these others. I love you more than them, Lord. That he trusted in his ability. He trusted that my desire is so great that nothing can take it away. He was trusting in his own resources, saying, yep, I'm confident. Why? Because I know that, you know, I love him so much that I will follow through. The question, right, that Peter asked him, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, feed my lambs. In verse 16, Jesus says a second time, he said to him again a second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, tend my sheep. Verse 17, he said to him the third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And what we see here is that Jesus' questions parallel the three times that Peter rejected him. Just as Peter publicly confessed not to know Jesus, right? He publicly rejected him. I do not know him. I'm not one of his disciples. Three times. So Jesus has him publicly confess his love for him three times. He says, do you love me? He questions him. And Jesus answers and affirms it positively. What we see here, though, the difference between his previous interaction and this one is Peter's response to Jesus' questions, right? Simple, straightforward. It's pretty much the same thing each time. He says, yes, I love you. Yes, I love you. The third time, right, it's like, man, he must have been just like so burdened with guilt at that point, you know, because he asked him the third time. I'm sure he was thinking about how he denied him three times. You know, he was grieved because Christ asked him the third time, and his response was, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. He's no longer comparing himself to the other disciples, right? He's not saying, I love them more than these other ones. He's not using his own resources. He's not saying, I will prove my love to you in this way. I will show you that I love you. Who does he appeal to? He appeals to the only one that he can. He appeals to Jesus Christ. He says, you know all things. I can't convince you of something. It's something that either you know or you don't, right? There's nothing that Peter can do to prove his love to the Lord. All he can say is trust Christ that he knows. He says, you know all things. You know that I love you. And the response of Christ, the third time, he says, Jesus said to him, feed my sheep once again. Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah,
actually, you bring up a great point, and I think it's something that you guys should know. A lot of people mention this in this this section, right? Is there's two different words for love being used. The first one is Jesus says, "Peter, do you agapao," which is the verbal form of agape, right? "Do you agape me?" And how does Peter respond? "I phileo you," right? So Jesus asks him, "Do you love me?" Peter responds, I love you," but he responds with a different word. And that happens in the first two questions. The first two times Jesus questions him, agape, phileo, agape, phileo. The third time Jesus says, "Peter, do you phileo me?" And Peter responds, "I phileo you." And some people have made like an issue with this. It's like, okay, Jesus is coming down to his level. And you know what? Like, I've taught that same thing at past times in my life. But from looking at it more closely, I don't think that that is like a relevant distinction. Those words, agape and phileo, cross over in terms of range of meaning, right? They can mean the same thing. They can mean different things too, right? But they can also mean the same thing. And we look at this section, right? So you look at it and Jesus responds the same way each time to Peter's answers. "I love you," and then he says, "Do you love me?" "I love you." "Do you love me?" "I love you." There's also variations of words in this same text where the Apostle John could have used the same Greek word, but he changes it up a little bit, and he does it for the same reason that we change up words in our sentences. Instead of saying the same thing three times in a row, you'll vary it slightly just for, you know, the enjoyment of speaking, right? Like if you say the same thing over and over and over again, sometimes you just kind of use a different word. You know, "I'm going to go run over," "I'm going to sprint," "I'm going to gallop." You know, well, there's some distinctions, but then there's also crossovers between those words. and also, in John's gospel, we see that the Father loves the Son. In John 3:35, it says that the Father loves the Son, right? That he agapes him. But two chapters later, in John 5:20, it says the Father loves the Son, and it says the Father phileos him. Are we going to make a distinction between that? Are we going to say, well, in this situation, God like truly loves the Son, and this one, he's got like an earthly love for him. It's not quite as good. Well, no. Is God going to love people in a substandard way? No. You know, God's love is perfect love. It's not like, oh, well, this is kind of like the junky love that God has at times. They mean the same thing. They can be used synonymously. Also, John 3:19 speaks of evil men who love darkness. You know what word is used there? The word agape. Do evil men have like a godly love of darkness? No, they just love it, right? They desire it. It's selfish. It's based on who they are and what they want, not based in God at all. So that Greek word, while in the epistles you see it used in a way where it's like it really is used in terms of God and his eternal love for people, it's kind of been like it's a word that's been glorified almost. That's one way that I like to think of it. Is in the epistles, they use it in a way, it's like, oh, this is great, that, you know, this is the love that God has. But really, you have to be dependent upon context to see, you know, what it means. You know, it's possible to translate it other ways in English. Also, if you look at verse 17, when he says, Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things." He uses the word oida. And then, "You know that I love you." He uses the word gnosko. Those are two different words for know there, right? Why are there two different words? I don't think he's trying to make some sort of theological distinction or bring out something by his language. I think he's varying his word usage because that's just good literature. You don't say the same thing over and over and over again. And The same thing's true here, right? He uses different words for, Lord, you know all things. That's Peter. You know that I love you. You know, he knows it, and he knows it. Different Greek words, but they mean, you know, they have a lot of crossover in what they mean, and I think in this situation, they mean the same thing. And I think it's the same thing about the Greek word love. And when you look at this section, right? Oh, yeah, Sean. No, no, go ahead. Well, I was transitioning. No, not in that time. Not in that time period. I mean, it can mean that. Yeah, and especially today, Christians, right? We have like these really like narrow categories. Phileo always means this. Agape always means this. Eros always means this. And storge always means this. But. It was love. I mean, it has a wide semantic range. Semantic range is just basically the possible ways to translate that word from Greek into English are multiple. Yeah, yeah, I mean, it could. But what you see with usage, though, especially in the epistles, that agape tends to be more like a divine type of love, a love that expects nothing in return. But that's more of a Christian idea. Agape love in Koine Greek, like the culture of the time, would have been more, okay, this is a love, but it's not a love that expects nothing in return. It's a love that expects reciprocation, right? Because that's usually love is reciprocated, and that what makes a good relationship. But in terms of God, God gives unreciprocated love, but he still gives it. Why? Because he's God. He doesn't necessitate reciprocation. He is loving because that's one of the attributes of who he is. And we receive that love from God, and we can also love people without reciprocation. Why? Because we receive it from God. But I think that's more based not on the Greek word, but on who God is. And we use it that way a lot, especially in the epistles because of just... in the epistles, for sure. It took on like an additional Christian meaning. Probably, yeah. Like if they're interacting with each other, yeah, they're probably speaking in Greek. But I mean, not Greek, Aramaic. But John's writing in Greek, you know, so he chose the words. But this section. So what's it about, right? If it's not about Peter loving, yeah, Tyler. No. Mm-hmm. John 5:20, it says the Father loves the Son. So, and their phileo is that time. And, you know, I think they're the same thing. They can be used interchangeably, although they're not exactly the same, right? They have a range that's outside of each other that they can be used for, but there's also crossover in the possible range of meaning of that word. So what's the point then? If the point is not that Peter loves the Lord insufficiently, but Jesus comes down to his level and meets him where he's at. I don't think that's the point of this section of Scripture. This is about restoring Peter for the work of the ministry, right? We know that Peter's in essentially a fallen state. He's rejected Christ before people. He has all of that guilt weighing in on him. And Jesus is using this opportunity to put him back into the position of restoration and ministering of the gospel to be a fisher of men. Jesus responds to Peter in this way, if you love me, his commission is explained with verbs. Tend my sheep, feed the flock. That's the response, is that if he loves him, he will prove it through his action and obedience to Christ. That's how we demonstrate our love for Christ. Right? Because Peter knows, right? You can't prove to him. It's like, I can say I love you, but you know all things, right? I'm saying it, and you can either accept that or reject it. And he commissions him to feed his sheep. Jake, did you have a question?
Yeah. I was just wondering how Jesus does the resurrection when he's going to land.
You know, I don't know. I think, yeah, I'm not sure. Like, maybe. Yeah, it could be a progression, or it could just be one of those things where John likes to vary the words that he uses because he gets bored using the same ones all the time. I mean, I can relate to that. Sometimes I get tired of my words. So, the commission of Peter, though, what is the commission? It's a verb. It's not explained by a position, right? It's not explained by a title. He doesn't say, Peter, if you love me, be the Pope, right? That's not what he's called to, but he's called to an action. He doesn't tell him, be a pastor. He doesn't tell him, hold a position in the church. The church belongs to Christ. Christ is the head of the church. Who has authority and leadership in the church? It's Jesus Christ. We're following after him. So what's the commission to Peter then? It's not to, you know, be in charge, but he's calling him to serve the church, to serve Christians, not rule over it, but to be a servant. And that's God's economy. When you look how Jesus explains, you know, their position, who's going to be greatest in heaven, the one who's the servant of all, that's God's economy. Those who are in authority are those who are put into positions to serve greater, right? Positions of greater authority are positions of greater service. The same thing's true here with Peter. When he's being commissioned, what's he being commissioned for? Not a position, not leadership, but service. And notice what qualifies him, right? He asks him, do you love me? He says, yes, I love you. If Peter loves Jesus, then Jesus can tell him, feed my sheep. It's not based on his past experiences, right? It's not based on his past qualifications. It's not based upon his past failures. He's not saying, well, like, be repentant for a certain amount of time and work your way back into my, like, good graces, and then maybe after a trial period, eventually you can start serving me again. But you've messed up big time, Peter, right? No, he goes through this for Peter's benefit. I don't think Jesus is doing this because it's like, yeah, then finally, I knew you were going to deny me and I'm going to, you know, get you. You're going to feel horrible and this is going to be great. No, he wanted to restore Peter. He wanted him to go through that, to come to grips with his failures and insufficiencies, that he doesn't love Jesus more than anybody else, right? That he's not able to do it. And we see that the commission of Peter is based on his love of Christ. Loving Jesus prepares us to love the saints. We're equipped through our relationship with Christ, not with our relationship with other Christians. He doesn't equip us by being, okay, well, you know these people or you served in this area. The more you love Christ, the more equipped you are for his service. Yeah, Ryan. Oh, this is like probably a week, couple weeks. You know, it's pretty soon afterwards because he would have denied him. Then it would have been 3 days. Then they would have been in Jerusalem for another week. Then they would have gone up to Galilee. So it doesn't make a specific reference to time, but it's pretty soon afterwards because, like, they only have a 50-day time period till the Holy Spirit comes upon them. So Jesus has got to be gone before then. So it's within the next month for sure. Yeah. Sure, I think we're wrong about tons of stuff. Yeah, and I think some people do love Jesus more than others. I mean, some people love basketball more than others, right? So we're equipped through our relationship with Christ, though. I think that's the point here, is that it's his love of Christ which qualifies him for service. That Peter's not being appointed to be a pastor, although he will pastor. He's not being appointed to a certain position, although he will take a position of authority in the early church. But he's being appointed to serve because of the love that he has for Christ and the love of Christ that is in him. And so we look at love in John's gospel, right? And love factors pretty prominently. It's used throughout. It's spoken about in the relationship of the Father and the Son. But as we examine that in a few of those different verses, I think you just want to be careful what conclusions you come to sometimes with those Greek words, because like Greek can be tricky, you know? Like, if you don't know it really well, like a lot of times you just have to depend on other people, and then when you depend on other people and their research, sometimes people are wrong too, so then if you trust them, you'll be wrong, but don't worry about it. I mean, you'll be all right. You'll be wrong about some stuff. You'll find out about it. Then you can be right and wrong about other stuff you don't know about. It's all right. Just don't be wrong about the really important ones, right? Like Jesus. Don't get that wrong. If you love Jesus, if you see him as your Savior, like, that'll carry you through most of the stuff that you're going through. And you could be wrong about some things, and you'll get right. Some stuff you'll never get right. It's all right. It's right? But when we look at the interaction between Jesus, I want you to look at the setting, right? They're in front of a charcoal fire here, like Jesus is cooking, and what do we see? Peter denying Christ first. It's outside, right, of the trial of Christ. He's in front of the fire. He denies him three times, right? We know that Jesus tells him, before the cock crows, you will deny me three times, and then sure enough, Peter denies him three times before the end of that day. And just as he denied Christ three times, here we see him affirming Christ three times. He affirmed his love for him. It says, most assuredly here in verse 18. So when we transition on, right? Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wish. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish. When Jesus affirms Christ, he says, most assuredly, this will happen. When Jesus said that he would never deny Christ, right? When he was making that statement in John 13:38. Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you? I will lay down my life for your sake. In 38, Jesus answered him, will you lay down your life for my sake? Most assuredly, I say to you, the rooster shall not crow till you have denied me three times. So, based upon his proclamation that I will never, ever deny you, Jesus says, most assuredly, I say to you, you will deny me. And in response to him saying, I love you, I love you, I love you, Jesus says, most assuredly, this is going to result in your life. And so we see that, you know, the language, the setting, and even the way that it played out, right? The circumstances all remind us of the connection between these two events. And it probably could be seen as, you know, really Peter's falling to the greatest depth in his time with the Lord, right? Denying him. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. Like, to deny him, especially since it's written about in all those Gospels. I mean, that's kind of a bummer for him. But we also see here that this is probably one of the greatest moments of restoration, though, that we see with the disciples, is because, you know, he could have expected to never, be involved in ministry, to be shamed for the rest of his life. And yet, as a result of this event, he came to grips with the fact that he's not able. Right? He can't do it. It's not about other people. It's about Christ and his relationship with him. And it's really cool to see Peter, you know, play a large role in the early church. So Jesus commissions Peter to the ministry. And he has a prediction here. Most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished. When you were old, you will stretch out your hands and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish. This is kind of like a play on words. Girding doesn't make too much sense, right? You're like, okay, gird, like, was that some sort of, like, girdle? Was he trying to work on his figure? I don't know what you guys think. But the New English translation, I think, kind of captures the play on words here. It says, I tell you the solemn truth. When you were young, You tied your clothes around you and went wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and others will tie you up and bring you where you do not want to go. So he's saying, you know what? Like when you were younger, you did whatever you wanted, right? You just went where you wanted. You dressed yourself. But in the end, for you, you're going to be tied up, you know, against your will. And it says that, you know, by another. And it says you will stretch out your hands. In the ancient world, this expression was often used for crucifixion. I mean, it spoke of them being stretched out on the cross. I mean, not all the time, but we know that Peter died. Ricky, we were talking about this last week, right? Like, where can you read about the deaths of the apostles and other books? And for Peter, like, there's a strong church tradition, right? Strong church history tradition that he was crucified upside down. The first mention of Peter's martyrdom that we have written down is from Clement of Rome, and that's around 68 AD. I mean, that's 96 AD. It was likely he was killed around 68 AD in Rome, but it doesn't tell how he died. Tertullian mentions Peter going to the cross in 212 AD. So you see, like, people were talking about it, and I'm sure there were witnesses, and Peter was a prominent figure in the early church, so who would know what happened to Peter? Well, Christians would know. You know, they'd say, oh, you know how Peter died? Well, he got crucified. You know how he was crucified upside down? And that's where in Eusebius, the bishop of Caesarea, he said that he wrote down that Peter was crucified upside down in 300 AD. And you can find, like, this information. It's in the Anti-Nicene church fathers' books. So you have to wade through it because they're, like, really brief mentions. It'll be, like, one sentence about Peter being crucified, and then it'll just move on to something totally different. But if you're interested, just pick up the Anti-Nicene church fathers and start reading, and you'll eventually hit it in volume 3. But yeah, so we see there's a prediction, right, that he's not going to have control. He's essentially going to be imprisoned, that he's going to be taken away, and that's what Jesus is telling them. If you love me, feed my sheep, and I'm telling you, you can count on this. Just like before, he told them, you can count on this, that you're going to deny me 3 times. Now, with the restoration, you can count on this, that you're going to be bound, you're going to be taken away, and you're probably going to be crucified. You know, if that's what he was saying there, then, you know, that's the promise of Christ. And that's what we read about in like, church history, is that eventually Peter was crucified upside down in Rome for his faith. So, cool, right? It's like, oh, yeah, I'm back in, like, the ministry. I've got this bright future ahead of me. It results in crucifixion. It's like, but that is the ministry, right? We're supposed to pick up our crosses daily and follow after Christ. Like, we will probably not have to pick up physical crosses, right? Like, nobody gets crucified anymore, just about. If you did, it's just because someone really wants to, like, torture you in a bizarre way or something like that. I mean, you could be killed for Christ today. But most of us in the United States, unless things change significantly, which is always possible, we're not going to be called to die for Christ, but we're still called to crucify ourselves, right? To take up our crosses daily and follow after him. You know, we think, okay, like, the physical is so easy. It's like, yeah, I'll do, you know, I would die for Christ. Peter was sure that he would die for Christ. And eventually he did. But I think that, you know, we neglect the things today, like bearing our cross, like investing in spiritual things, and yet we claim so boldly, I would die for my faith today. Well, let me ask you, are you willing to live for your faith today? Because we see Peter, right? He's promised to die for his faith, but it seems like Peter, I love him because he gives me hope for ministry. Then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who also had leaned on his breast at the supper, and said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "But Lord, what about this man?" Right? First thing, Jesus is like, this is what's going to happen to you. What about John? Right? What's going to happen to him? And he begins to, you know, seemingly compare himself to others again, see what's happening with other people. Jesus said to him, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me." Jesus says, you know, this colloquial expression, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you?" I would say, mind your own business, right? Like, what does that have to do with you? That's none of your business, Peter. What if I, you know, will that he stays alive until I return? He repeats the call to Peter, though. He says, "You," and it's emphatic, right? The emphasis is he's talking to Peter, he's telling me, don't worry about these other people, but you follow me. That's the same call that's being given to each one of us today, right? He's not calling us to be someone else. He's not calling us to do someone else's ministry. He's saying, you, today, don't worry about what other people are doing, right? Don't worry what God's call is for their life. You worry about one thing. You worried about following Jesus Christ. God's going to work out those other things. He's in charge of the church, right? Christ is the head. He's the leader, and he's working it out in people's lives. But you, today, you follow Christ. That's his call. Each person is accountable to the Lord for their own service, right? I'm not going to be held accountable for, you know, what Dave Shirley is doing here. Like, I'm not going to get to heaven one day and God's going to be like, "I'm very disappointed in you, Daniel." I don't know how he speaks, but, you know, like, you really should have been handling Dave Shirley better. I thought that, you know, he could have done a lot more, and it's your fault, right? That's not, God's not going to put, like, Dave Shirley's works before me and be like, "Look at all this wood, hay, and stubble that's burning up," or "Look at all this amazing treasure that he's getting." You know, I don't know. God's the judge, right? I think he's pretty good, but I don't have divine wisdom to see his heart. He's going to say, "Hey, you follow me. You didn't follow me. You did follow me." That's going to be the judgment, right? I'm accountable for my service before the Lord, not anybody else's. Not my roommates, not my friends, not my family. Now, oftentimes I'm called to do things, right? I'm called to invest in my friends, to maybe hold someone accountable, and I'm responsible for that. I'm not saying forget them. It's like, yeah, I really see Kaylin going down a bad road, but not my problem, right? Mind your own business. I don't care. He's accountable before the Lord. No, like, as a Christian, I love him, and I'm going to be like, "Oh, Kaylin, is it okay if I use your name as an example?" Good. It's just a hypothetical example. You know, I see, like, you know, you really, the Lord's put you on my heart, and, you know, that's appropriate. You know, that's something that's good to do, but I'm not held accountable for somebody else's service. I'm only held accountable for my own. That's what's going to be judged. Each person is accountable to the Lord for their own service, not for what the person next to them is doing, not for the person who they're in ministry with, but themselves. Then this saying went out among the brethren that the disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you?" So it seems like John's been alive for probably around, well, if this happened around 30 and the book was written around 90, this is another, how many years is that? 60 years after this point in time he's writing it. And it seems like in that time period, people are like, "Did you hear? John's going to be alive until the Lord comes back." And I'm sure he's heard this a number of times. He's been like, "Guys, that's not what he said." Well, he's setting the record straight here. Jesus didn't say that I would be back, I would live until he came back. He just said, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you?" So he's correcting the misconception of Jesus' words, and he's also affirming his testimony. Right? Because John was there, he's able to speak, he's able to tell what happened here. And according to church tradition, and like this is pretty strong church tradition, it's not just like, "Oh, maybe this happened," like, unless there's something that, you know, discounts it, most likely John was not martyred. He was one of the few disciples, if maybe the only disciple, that wasn't martyred for his faith. Now, he's persecuted. He was tortured, it seemed. He was in prison, but he didn't die, right? So he was one of the few original apostles to escape martyrdom. He would have died of old age. And we see Peter was called to die for the Lord, right? And Peter probably had another 30 years of ministry before he was eventually crucified in like 68 AD. But, you know, he was called by Jesus. He's like, you're going to die for me one day. But John, I see, John was called to live for Christ. I think he has a powerful testimony. If you read the epistles, like, of John, they're so sweet. They're written by an old saint filled with the love of God, speaking to people he loves. I mean, there's nothing sweeter than reading through 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John and seeing the apostle's heart for believers. He's caring for them. And it's like he lived a life that was set aside for the Lord. And what I think we often miss is that he saw all of the men that he worked and labored with killed, crucified in horrible ways. James, his brother, was the first martyr, right? He would have seen his brother killed, and he would have gone on with the rest of his ministry knowing, oh man, like there, my brother was crucified for Christ, and yet he continued on talking about the power, transforming power that was in Christ, how people ought to believe in it, that it was worth dying for. And he was well acquainted with it, right? He saw his friends, he saw his loved ones killed for the cross. But his calling was not to die for Christ. His calling was to live for him, to minister for him. You know, a man who was given to contemplation, right? A man who was given to, like, reflecting upon the works that Christ did. We have the Gospel of John because the Lord tarried, right? That the Lord didn't call him home. We have the epistles of John. Why? Because the Lord called John to a ministry of life, not a ministry of dying for Christ. And I think, you know, for us, yeah, like I was saying earlier, maybe, like, it's possible that you might be called to die for your faith. It's possible. Most likely things will have to change drastically. But you are called to live for your faith today. I think oftentimes that's the harder, right? Because dying for Christ, that's a one-time decision. Your encounter with it, it's like, are you going to deny Christ? No. And you die for it, right? But every day, you know, you have the option to feast upon the spiritual banquet that's available to you, or you have the option to just do your own thing, right? To ignore the resources that God has for you, to ignore the growth and development he wants for your life in Christ. And so you're deciding by your actions either to live for Christ today or to reject him today. And I'm not talking about rejection as in, like, oh, you're not saved or something like that. I'm talking about, do we have fellowship with Christ on a daily basis? Do we live for him on a daily basis? Because I think that we can live for him, and we can also not live for him. I mean, it's possible, even as a Christian, to live for yourself, to live for the flesh, to sow to the flesh and to, you know, really represent your old man instead of you being a new creation in Christ. So we look at John's example of a life spent in service to the Lord, and you compare that with, you know, Peter, who it seems like he was commissioned to die for the Lord. Different callings, different men, but they're each responsible for their own service, right, unto God. Follow after the Lord. Don't follow after another person. And so the conclusion of John's gospel in verse 24 and 25, it says, "This is the disciple who testifies of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true." You know, it was common in documents in the Greco-Roman world and even in Judaism that they would, you know, on legal documents that the witness would claim, you know, hey, like, I'm the witness and what I'm saying is true. It's like going into a courtroom saying, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, right? You're just saying, hey, I told you this and I'm swearing that it's true. We learn in chapter 19, verse 35, and also in 21:25, that the witness was an eyewitness testimony, right? The writer of John's gospel is writing about things that they've seen. So not only are they telling you the truth, they're telling you the truth about that which they have observed. And this makes a pretty solid case for John's gospel being reliable, and also John being the author of John's gospel, right? Because who else has access to these things? Who else knows what happened in all of these different situations? Well, the Apostle John. You know, he's the one who would have been around. He's the one who can testify that these things are true. So we have a good case for it being reliable eyewitness testimony from the Apostle John. In verse 25, he says, there are also many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. Amen. And so what we see here is in the natural sense of this statement, it probably would be possible, if you wrote down every detail of like Jesus' life, to contain that in the world with books, right? Like, okay, like you could describe accurately, even with like really embellished language, describing minute details, what Jesus did while he was here for 33 years. The world's pretty big. Books are very small, right? You could probably do it. This is hyperbolic. Hyperbole is when you exaggerate something in order to make a point, right? He's saying that Jesus did great things on the earth, and if we wrote them all one by one, the earth couldn't contain it. Like in the literal sense, it probably could. But figuratively, right? In the spiritual sense, though, I think that this statement is true, literally. I mean, I think that if you were to write about the eternal work that Jesus did on the cross in the spiritual realm, that you would exhaust all the resources in the world trying to write about it. Why? Because it's an eternal work, right? You would write on forever and ever and ever. Not only would you fill up the whole world, you would fill up all of time, because time is not going to ever be able to sufficiently express the eternal work of God. You know, it was a great work that was done on the cross. I have no problem with him saying that, you know, the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. So I guess tonight's the night of poetry, because I have like a verse from it's a song, and I always am curious, like, where did this come from? And I read a few different stories. I don't know which one's true. I just know the words are good, but one of them was that, like, when they were clearing out a room in an insane asylum, that these words were scrawled on the wall, and they're like, well, they must have been sane when they wrote it. That's kind of strange to me, but... and then the other is actually written by a rabbi in 1000 AD. But here's how the verse goes. It says, could we with ink the ocean fill, and were the skies of parchment made, were every stalk on earth a quill, and every man a scribe by trade, to write the love of God above would drain the ocean dry, nor could the scroll contain the whole, though stretched from sky to sky. Now it just reminds me of how vast, how deep, and how enduring God's love is. I mean, there's so much that's based in our Christian life upon the love of God. Right? If we know the love of God, we can be effective ministers. To know God is to know love. I mean, you can't get around it. If you know him, you know his love. Because it's an essential attribute of who God is. You know, Jesus Christ was compelled by love to come to the cross. So as we look at John's gospel, right, he finishes it up affirming his testimony. And the reason why is because he wrote this gospel so that we people would believe, right? That was the point of the gospel, is that we might believe in him, that we might believe in Jesus Christ. That's the whole reason he set out to write this gospel. He was probably already aware of the synoptic gospels, right? Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It had already been written. It's likely that John would have known about them. So why write another gospel? For the purposes of belief. Not just belief for those who don't know Jesus, but belief for you guys. that your belief would be increased by seeing the works of Jesus Christ here on this earth and seeing the ramifications of it in your life. That your belief, I pray, I hope that your belief has been grown through this class. That as you read the gospel, that it compels you to service of the Lord, that it compels you to seek him, that it makes it real to you. Because there's so many things today that are vying for our attention, that are competing for our affection. And, you know, our society has really mastered, you know, the psychology, the art, the business of getting people's attention. You know, people go to college, they get master's degrees, they get doctorates, just based around the fact that they can get people's attention well. And we have a culture where distractions are numerous. They're always present. They're ever ready. And you know that. You know that in your own life, that there are things that are competing for your attention today. Don't let those things take the place of Christ. Let him be real in your life. Let him be effective in your life. If nothing else, I hope that going through this gospel has helped you to encounter Jesus Christ in a deeper way, that he's more real to you than when we started this semester. You know, take these things and apply them to your lives. Don't just let it be an intellectual knowledge, but let it be something that affects your life as a whole, that you are transformed and changed because of the work of Christ. Every time you hear something about Christ, you know it's true, let that affect your life. Belief. Belief that leads to action. So I think that's pretty much all I have for the Gospel of John. I don't know if you guys have any questions or comments about anything we've gone through. Yeah, Sean? I don't know. I mean, it's part of a song. I mean, I could give it to you if you want it, and you could just have it. I found it in William Hendrickson's commentary on John's Gospel is the first place that I saw it. So, I mean, you can find it in there if you want. They have it. It's like the New Testament commentary by William Hendrickson in the library. And if you look up the section on John 21, it should be towards the end there. Anything else? Yeah, I love you guys. Are great. So, there. If you have anything that you need to deal with in terms of grades, hang out. We'll try to take care of it tonight. And if we can't resolve it tonight, we'll basically get all the information we can and then try to take care of it tomorrow. There's Timmy. I need to see you after class. So hang out. And pick up your homework. So the last portion of class participation is your homework is over there. If you've never visited the bin, or even if you have this semester, go through there and find your homework and take it home for you. Because if you don't, we'll turn it into confetti and use it for a parade for the graduates tomorrow. That's not going to happen, but I kind of wish that would. That'd be the best. It's like, oh, this is such great confetti. Yeah, we use all of people's old homework. All right. Would somebody like to pray for us before we go? And then, you want? Sure. Yeah. Okay. And then we'll go. And thank you guys. I really love going through this class with you. And fill out an evaluation too. So if you haven't done that, go online, click on the evaluation, fill it out for, even if you don't do it for any of your other teachers, just do it for this one. And be mean as you want. Like, seriously, like, put anything you didn't like about the class, anything you thought was, you know, could be better, because those things really helped me out. If you really enjoyed something, you could mention that too. But if everybody's really nice, the class will never, ever get any better. So, you know, and it's anonymous. I won't know if you said mean things about me, and I won't hold it against you anyway. I grew up with, like, older brothers, so I've got thick skin.